welcome to Aerium Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 23rd of March 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAlbion.com. Well, we've had a week off, and you were treated to Greatest Britons last week instead of the Daily Nationalist. Instead of Aerium Britannia, you had the Patriotic Conference speeches, but this week we are back. Aerium Britannia is back, and I do have my co-host with me, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good afternoon to you, sir. It's a glorious, glorious spring day here where I am. What's it like where you are over the other side of the country?
It is a similarly glorious spring day, actually, yes. And it's just a shame this past weekend has featured a rather more lonely Mother's Day than I think a lot of mothers would have ideally hoped for. But let's hope that the bright weather made up for that, and let's hope that they've all had plenty of Skype calls and FaceTime calls and things of this sort, so that they're keeping in touch with their children and grandchildren.
Yes, of course, because even though the weather's hotting up and it's a beautiful day out there, we've got all the coronavirus problems to talk about. And I really wanted to sort of concentrate on the British response today. Last week, I talked a little bit about the disease itself and about the economy. And what we should really concentrate on here is the British response. And there's been, you know, it's a different response to elsewhere, where there's been total lockdowns in Italy, total lockdown in Spain, total lockdown in Germany. And over here in Britain, they've just closed the schools, the restaurants and the pubs, and they're leaving everything else open. And that's the first thing I really wanted to bring up. I mean, do you think that's going far enough, Max, just closing schools, restaurants and pubs? Or do you think that, you know, we should be told you're not allowed to leave your home at all, and if the police catch you, you could be fined, which is what they're doing in Italy and Spain at the moment? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts are that a completely different approach ought to have been adopted right from the very beginning. What we have now is the situation where virtually all of the old traditional conservative premises, especially with regard to the economy, have just been thrown out the window. The old conservative premises of there not being a magic money tree and of prudence as far as the economy is concerned, all these things seem to have been cast to the wind. And Boris Johnson's government appears to be embracing the most extensive movement into state intervention and socialism that has been seen in the modern era, I think. What we're faced with is a situation where there is a large degree of what, in my view, is unnecessary compulsion, which, you know, that's the direction that we're heading in, that increasingly these measures that are required, that are introduced to have us effectively self-isolate and are being ramped up to the point where there are soon going to be legally enforceable instructions that various businesses and things have to close down. Now, already the government has said that they want businesses to close down, and there's been some reaction to this on the part of Tim Martin from Wetherspoons. He's been in the press today, where he's been speaking out about this and saying that he thinks that the government's reaction is over the top. The point is that as far as the coronavirus is concerned, it mainly presents a danger to people who are over the ages of 70 and who have underlying health conditions that make them vulnerable to lung infections. As far as the vast majority of the population are concerned, it is a lot less dangerous, and in many cases that have been reported anecdotally through the press, it has turned out to be something which is ranges from the same sort of severity as a common cold through to the same sort of severity as a bad dose of the flu might have done in any previous year. And I think that what the government have done is that they originally had this policy of trying to increase what was described as being herd immunity, which was a really bad choice of words there, because by describing it as herd immunity, herd automatically conjures up symbols of cows, and it kind of suggests that the government is valuing human life on the same sort of level that they're valuing the life of a cow. And so that was unfortunate that they chose those words. But I think that there is something to be said for aiming for a or having a strategy where the government is aiming for a higher level of natural immunity amongst the population than exists at present. And at present, there probably isn't any natural immunity because this coronavirus is something which is entirely new. However, what we're doing is we're closing down progressively more and more industries, so that we've got the hospitality industry, we've got the hotels, we've got schools, we've got museums, etc. All of these kind of industries and enterprises are all being closed down, and they're being closed down for an indeterminate period of time. Although the government has stepped in and said, oh yes, we'll spend loads and loads of money, you know, we'll spend whatever it takes to make this work, the fact of the matter is that these industries are being closed down, and lots of them, lots of the companies that eventually end up going under and going belly up as a result of what's going on, they are never ever going to be revived again in the future. And so you know, Tim Martin has indicated that he expects that we have already launched ourselves on a path which is going to lead to a severe recession. And I have to confess that I suspect that he's right on this, that, that what will happen is that we will save marginally more lives as a result of having this this policy of lockdown than might have otherwise happened, but we will end up at the end of the period with an economy which is totally and utterly shot to pieces, and which will probably mean that we will be in a recession for the next 10 years or more before we start to come out of it.
Well, I would hope that you know, that might be a chance for them to completely reform the economy and take usury out of it and reset everything. I mean, it's a perfect chance for that. But just let me make a couple of points here about what you were saying there. So what I'm guessing that what you're sort of suggesting is that maybe the only people that should have really been quarantined were maybe the over 60s, those that were likely to have severe complications, and but the problem with the herd immunity is it would require 60% of the population to actually get the virus to acquire a herd immunity, and that would mean that there would be like something like a million deaths in order to get that far. That's why they changed course on that one, and of course all of this could have been avoided if they just hadn't been scared of being called racist. I mean, that's what it all boils down to. We should have quarantined China.
If we just go back to the herd immunity thing, what you're assuming is that the current course that we're on is going to avoid there being large numbers of deaths. The fact of the matter is that we're in a situation where the virus has already escaped containment and is at large within our community. And okay, we can slow down the spread, but I personally don't think that we are actually going to be able to stop the spread. So I think that unless somebody comes up with a vaccine very quickly, the virus is going to spread to 100% of the population. And so of that 100% of the population, the statistics show that something like 2% of those people will die. And I think that, you know, whether it happens quickly or whether it happens over an extended period of time, we probably are going to look at there being an enormous number of deaths as a result of the virus being at large. I think as far as the government is concerned, by taking the path that they're taking now, not only will we have a very large number of deaths, but we will have our economy shot to pieces at the end of it as well, and the country virtually bankrupted. If we look at, I can't remember the name of this, the latest Chancellor of the Exchequer now,
Rishi Sunak.
I mean, he was reported as the first budget that he delivered was a budget where he introduced measures to deal with the coronavirus. And one of the quotations that I've got here from the press is that the British government has announced measures in its annual budget worth £12 billion to help the economy deal with the coronavirus outbreak. Independent economists, or sorry, independent economic forecasters say it represents UK's biggest spending boost for over a quarter of a century. Well, 12 billion is totally and utterly dwarfed by the 330 billion that he announced about 4 days ago and the extra 10 billion or so that he's announced since then. So what we're looking at is an absolutely massive increase in public spending and a massive, and there's been talk of the government buying up shares in BA to keep BA afloat. So what we're looking at here is a kind of nationalization of the economy, where large sectors of the economy are going to have to be taken over by the government and are going to be paid for by the government. And the salaries of the people that work in those sections of the economy are going to be paid for, or 80% of their salaries are going to be paid for by the government, up to whatever it was, £2,500 a month or whatever, which is an absolutely massive increase. If I sort of continue with those quotations that I was doing before, public sector borrowing over the next 4 years would now rise to £290 billion compared to a forecast in December of £194.2 billion, the Office for Budget Responsibility stated. Well, that was Rishi Sunak's budget at the beginning of this month. And as I say, he has spent an extra £340 billion more than that now. So he's spent in one go, or he's proposing to spend in one go, more than the increase in public, the increase in total public borrowing that would have been made over the next 4 years. And so that sort of kind of brings into perspective the amount of borrowing that's going on here. And
and quantitative easing. And quantitative easing, Max. Don't forget that. They've introduced quantitative easing. The money printer goes brr, brr, brr for constantly now. They're actually pumping loads of money into it that they just, that isn't actually borrowed as well. I think they're going to have to do more of that.
But those kind of things, if it's done to excess, is going to cause inflation on a massive scale. And inflation on a massive scale is going to mean that people's savings and their investments that they've accumulated, all the people that we're trying to save their lives of, all these people below above the age of 70, a very large number of which will have some savings and investments. What we're going to find is that because of runaway inflation that could well occur as a result of all this spending, that could cause the value of those investments to diminish to such an extent that the people survive but are then completely denuded of their life savings, because their life savings will become worth so little. And this is the kind of danger that we're facing. What the government should have done, in my view, is that they should have sent out a registration card to everybody, every elector within the economy, within the country rather. And that registration card should have asked people whether they wanted to be quarantined or whether they wanted to be part of the section of the population that carried on life as normal. And then all the people that wanted to be quarantined could have had arrangements made for them where they could be taken away and put in very isolated communal groups away from the rest of the population. And they would have primarily been people who would have been retired anyway. And so large numbers of them could have just stayed in their house and could have just made we could have just made arrangements to have food delivered to their house. But then the vast majority of the population who are going to be below the age of 60 and who, for whom the threat of the coronavirus is very, very slight, they could have just carried on life as normal, carried on working, carried on building houses, carried on building cars, carried on growing fruit and vegetables in the fields or whatever it happens to be. And they could have suffered the coronavirus, and it would have been like a cold, or it would have been like a bad dose of flu at the worst for most of them. And after 6 months or so, the virus would have run its course, it would have been spent, and the people that remained would have been people who have all had the virus and who all then will have built up antibodies to the virus. And the people who are vulnerable to the virus would have been kept in isolation for that sort of 6 month period. They could have come out of isolation and it would all been okay, and the economy would have been undamaged or only damaged to a limited degree. Whereas what's likely to happen as a result of what we're going through now is that we're going to come out of this, because government ministers are talking about 18 months. They're talking sometime, some people were talking yesterday about it being taking even longer than that, it being years and years before we get back to normality. And if it take if it's years and years of government borrowing on the scale that the government have committed themselves to so far this year, then the amounts that they're going to borrow are going to be so astronomically high that the country is probably going to struggle to function. It's going to, we're going to struggle to have any kind of functioning economy as a result of this.
We'll be in the position of Germany after the Versailles Treaty. And you know what happened there. I mean, I do think, you know, this is a, you know, this is an opportunity for nationalism, really, because nationalist policies would have prevented this. Once people's grandparents and their parents start dying, you know, they're going to be furious. They're going to be like, why the hell did we not quarantine China? Well, because the government didn't want to be called racist once again. You know, this is just cosmic justice, basically. I do think, though, that if we look back at the SARS epidemic, which is another coronavirus, as soon as the sun came out, as soon as it was summertime, the SARS virus just disappeared. And this is the same thing. This coronavirus, it's got a lipid wall that can't stand the heat, basically. So in 3 months' time from now, we could be in a very different situation. Plus, we've got this malaria drug that they're talking about that looks like it might well be effective. I do think we could be in a different situation from 3 months from now. But we were talking there about inflation, Max. I mean, what we're seeing now is price gouging, particularly in Muslim shops, where they're putting up the prices of loo roll to like £5 a roll. Hand sanitizer, you know, £20 for 50 milliliters of hand sanitizer. We've seen all this price gouging going on. Whereas centuries ago in Britain, if there was some kind of catastrophe, rather than having price gouging, there would be what was called a just price. And prices would actually come down. Because if it was something that everybody needed, obviously everybody needed it. It was essential. So the government would step in and they'd subsidize it so that it was at an affordable price for everyone. Say that there'd been an earthquake and people needed to rebuild their houses. Well, building materials would be subsidized. Whereas because of this capitalist communist system that we have today, when something like this, when a tragedy like this occurs, everybody starts putting the prices up. And you can't really criticize that because that is capitalism, isn't it? It's, you know, it's taking advantage of other people's misery to make as much profit as you can is seen as the goal. Whereas in nationalism, it's what is best for the nation is seen as the goal. I do think your ideas there, Max, they're very, very sensible. It's a shame, you know, you're not one of Boris Johnson's advisors. And talking of the shops and the stocks in the shops, I mean, I live in a very fairly rural area and there hasn't really been any difficulty. Going in the shops, there's no loo roll on the shelves, but they've got it all out the back. So just to make sure that people aren't walking out of the shop with, you know, dozens and dozens of rolls of it. But nobody seems to be, you know, going crazy like they are in the cities, like they are in London. There's actually been looting going on in London. The shelves are all bare. People can't get hold of the stocks that they need. Have you seen any price gouging, Max? What's your impression of what the shops are like where you are? You're in England, obviously, and I'm in Wales.
I haven't seen any evidence where I live of prices being inflated as a result of inflation. So I think that the majority of British people around the country are reacting responsibly in that respect. There has been a lot of panic buying, though, and I think that the panic buying is a feature of the loss of confidence that people have in governments telling the truth. And I think that, you know, we've lived now through several decades, probably the last 5 or 6 decades, where it's become a commonplace thing for politicians to lie and to state things that are patently untrue. We've only got to look back to the Brexit campaigns with the sort of campaign of fear that was waged by the government trying to terrify everybody into voting for our continued membership of the European Union, and then trying to terrify everybody with the prospect of what might happen if we didn't agree to the terms that were offered to us by the European Union for our leaving the European Union, etc., and the Project Fear that was launched, all this kind of thing. And people have had decades of this now. And so when the government turns around to them and says to them, oh, you know, we will make sure, you know, the supply chains are full, people think, oh, yeah, I'd like to believe that, but I don't know whether I can. And so self-preservation clicks in as far as people are concerned. And they think, well, I'd like to believe that, but I don't know that I can. And so I'm just going to pop out to the shops and make sure that my family aren't left destitute or left without the vital supplies that they need. And so what this is a major lesson for governments, really, that, you know, what's been happening in the country over the last few weeks. A major lesson, first of all, in telling the truth and being honest. And I think that there have been a number of people that have pundits in the media that have pointed to government scientific officer and the government's chief government health officer. I can't think what their names off the top of my head.
Nadine Dorries, she got the virus, didn't she? She was, I think she was the Minister of Health. Nadine Dorries, is that who you were mentioning?
No. There were two men that have generally stood either side of Boris Johnson when he's been making his daily reports. But the point is that they've been singled out by pundits in the media for being people who the public feel they can trust. And I think the public feel they can trust them because they see that both those two men as scientists as opposed to seeing them as politicians. And Boris Johnson stands in the middle as a politician, although he does his best to convey whatever message he wants to convey. He is regarded as a politician, and so therefore a lot of people will take whatever he says with a pinch of salt, and that's a shame. And I think that what governments need to do in future years now is to undertake a program of rebuilding public confidence in what leaders tell them, because if these kind of pandemics are going to become common in the future, and there's no reason to believe that they won't become common in the future, then what we need are national leaders that people instinctively feel that they can believe, rather than national leaders that people instinctively feel they can't believe, but, you know, desperately want to believe, but instinctively feel that they can't. The other factor as well is that for several decades now, we've been building a global economy, and part of the rationale on the part of the Conservative government for leaving the European Union was so that we could become a global trading entity again. And I think that what's happened with the coronavirus has kind of fired three torpedoes into that ship, and we can now see the weakness that aiming to become a global nation creates. I don't think we need to want to become a global nation. We need to become a self-sufficient nation. We need to become a nation that grows its own food again, a nation that makes its own steel, a nation that mines its own coal, that generates its own electricity, that owns its own electricity production facilities, etc., that owns its own utilities, instead of being a nation where lots and lots of foreign companies own our utilities, own our power industry, own our railway industry, etc. We need a wholesale move away from the globalism of the past, and a revitalization of nationalism as far as the economy is concerned, so that when this kind of thing happens, we can just put up the barriers, stop people from coming in and out of the country, and know that our country can carry on functioning almost unaffected behind an iron wall of defence. And that our people will continue to receive the food and vital supplies of medicines, etc., that they need, irrespective of what goes on elsewhere in the world. Because what we can see in the European Union is that the European Union isn't standing as one. And okay, we've opted out now, but the rest of the other 26 nations are all there. And instead of standing as one, they've all decided to lock down their own borders to stop people from travelling across from one European Union country to another European Union country. So they've got control. And by doing what they're doing, they are actually telling the rest of the world that nationalism is what counts when the chips are down. Because when the chips are down, they have to do all the things that a nationalist government would want to do. And so people need to start thinking about this for the future. And, nationalism isn't all about disliking foreign people coming to our country, etc., blah, 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 blah. Nationalism is about making our people secure in an uncertain world. And the world is becoming more and more uncertain. The only certainty in the world today is that change will happen and that the speed of change will accelerate. And so in a world of accelerating change, we need something that we can hold on to that we know is solid, something that we can hold on to that we know it, you know, will not change and will always be there to support us when we need it.
And that's what the nation is. I mean, you can look at it on the macro scale and the micro scale. I think on the macro scale, you've got globalism, multiculturalism that has brought us this disease. And then you can look at it at the micro scale, and you can look at the parts of the country that still have 99.9% white people in them. And they're all pulling together. There's plenty of stuff on the shelves. People are helping one another out. The police have said actually people have been very altruistic rather than, trying to profit from this. And obviously they're talking about the white areas, because in London, in the multicultural areas, you've got looting, you've got price gouging, you've got stuff being taken off the shelves. So when you've got an ethnically homogenous area, everybody is looking after each other. And when you've got a mixed area, then it's everybody out for themselves. And one thing that has really annoyed me is this sanitizer thing. You know, you would expect that every shop you went into, everywhere that you went into, they would have hand sanitizer right by the till so that people could use it after putting their pins into the credit card machines or after they've handed cash over. Maybe just put some hand sanitizer on before you walk around the store, before you hand all the goods in the store. Very, very few of them have got hand sanitizer out. When I was in England last week, there were places that said, we can't put hand sanitizer out because it will get stolen. And obviously this is in the multicultural areas. The government should have, it should have sent loads of hand sanitizer out along with the post to just about every house. It's not like it's expensive stuff. You know, it's very, very cheap to make. And yet there's a shortage of hand sanitizer. Apparently there was a lorry full of sanitizer that was held up in France because France has said that they're going to requisition all masks and hand sanitizer and stuff. And this hand sanitizer was supposed to be coming over for the NHS and it was actually held up. Exactly the same with masks. There were FFP3 masks that were held up at France for exactly the same reason. And they're still giving out false information about masks on the BBC. They're being guarded with the language. When asked about whether, you know, people should be wearing masks, they instantly start talking about masks that aren't going to be any good anyway. They say, oh, well, if you've got a bit of cloth over your face, it's only going to stop large droplets. It's not going to stop small droplets. So we're not advising people to wear masks. Yet if you've got an FFP3 mask, then that specifically screens out the virus because it's got a micron mesh in it that prevents the virus from being able to get through. And instead of telling people, well, yes, if you have the proper mask, if you have the required mask, then yes, that will prevent airborne viruses getting in. They're just not telling people that, which I think is very, very deceitful. Do you want to say something there, Max?
If you've got a mask where you've got a coarse gauge mask that perhaps isn't going to stop the very finest droplets, at least it will be stopping the largest droplets. And I would imagine that it's the largest droplets that are going to be the most dangerous, that are going to contain the largest number of pathogens. It makes sense, doesn't it? And so I think that it is scandalous that there haven't been enough of this sort of protective equipment available for the NHS. And if you think about the threats, and I watched on the internet a speech made by Bill Gates about 5 years ago in which he said that there isn't really a very big threat that tens of millions of people will die as a result of a nuclear war in the next sort of foreseeable future, whatever that period of years he was looking over. He said, but there is a very real risk that tens of millions of people will die from a pandemic. And so what he pointed out was that the money that countries are spending on maintaining nuclear deterrence, the money that countries are spending on maintaining their armed forces, who all just stand in readiness waiting to be called into action, even though there isn't a war currently being waged and even though there isn't a need for them to actually exist at the moment. But what we need, and this is what Bill Gates was saying in his speech, is what we need is for countries to have those same kind of resources standing, waiting in the wings to be introduced as soon as a pandemic is identified, so that we can protect ourselves and prevent tens of millions of people worldwide from dying. And I think that makes perfect sense. You know, that is the sort of thing that we need from the point of view of protecting our population. And it's a similar argument, really, which is used against, with regard to terrorism. You know, terrorism is something which is far more likely to kill people than an actual war at the moment. And yet, constantly there are cutbacks in government expenditure and cutbacks in, provision for the forces of law and order that are supposed to prevent, terrorism from flourishing internationally. As far as we in Britain are concerned, we've only got something like, I think it's something like four small ships that sail backwards and forwards in the English Channel to stop people from coming across the Channel in boats. And in fact, they don't stop people. They just intercept them and then ferry them ashore so that they can complete their journey. But, you know, what we ought to have is far more spending on the defence of our borders as well. And all of this thinking needs to be absorbed so that once this crisis with coronavirus is over, we can look forward to a future with a far saner government policy.
It's absolutely scandalous that the NHS haven't got FFP3 masks. Just absolutely scandalous. You know, they're being told, oh, all you need to wear is a cloth mask and a little plastic apron. You know, and they're leaning over these COVID-19 patients, and of course these doctors are catching the virus and then they're spreading it to others. It's horrific. Well, we'll just have to see what happens over the next few weeks, I guess, and see whether this hot weather does help, see whether we do get some kind of antiviral agent from this malaria drug that's been spoken about. And we'll just have to see if this trajectory is as bad as we have been warned about. Well, I don't know if you want to add any more to that, Max, or shall we move into Cecil Rhodes now?
I think we've said just about everything we can say about the coronavirus today.
Okay, yeah. Well, let's move on to Cecil Rhodes then, our greatest Briton. Last week we talked about the influence Freemasonry had on him, about him then wanting to form his own secret society to further the aims of the British Empire, or to further the aims of the Anglo-Saxon race, particularly the British branch of it. How he started out his diamond company with a little bit of help from Rothschilds, how he became Prime Minister Rhodes, and then he became a frontiersman. And when we left him last week, he was basically doing lots of deals with British Empire people to colonize new land. And one of the new lands that he ended up colonizing and naming after him was Rhodesia. In 1889, Rhodes obtained a charter from the British government for his British South Africa Company, BSAC, to rule, police, and make new treaties and concessions from the Limpopo River to the Great Lakes of Central Africa. By the end of 1894, the territories over which the BSAC had concessions or treaties, collectively called Zambezia, after the Zambezi River flowing through the middle, comprised an area of 1,143,000 kilometres squared between the Limpopo River and Lake Tanganyika. In May 1895, its name was officially changed to Rhodesia, reflecting Rhodes' popularity among settlers who had been using the name informally since 1891. So that gives us an idea of what his stature was among the settlers and among the white people there. I mean, he must have been an absolute hero for them to name the country after him, don't you think, Max? I mean, you must know, probably know more about Rhodesia than me. I don't really remember much about it before it became Zimbabwe, which is obviously we all know what happened there. But what are your thoughts on Rhodesia, and what are your thoughts on it being named after Cecil Rhodes, Max?
Well, I think it is only appropriate that it should be named after Cecil Rhodes. After all, he was the person who was mostly responsible for the land being acquired and civilization being extended into that area. I think it's fairly clear from what you've just said, and I think you're absolutely right, that Cecil Rhodes was regarded as a kind of a colossus standing across the continent of South Africa, and that was reflected in the high level of respect that people had for him.
I think I've seen a cartoon image of a giant Rhodes, like a giant colossus, sort of standing astride Africa, making him out to be like the Greek colossus. I'm sure I've seen that image somewhere.
Oh, one of Rhodes, now you say that, I think that I perhaps have seen something like that myself, because that may have just stimulated my imagination into saying what I've just said.
Well, it illustrates it perfectly, doesn't it? Really. Well, one of his Rhodes dreams, shared by other members of the British Empire, was for a red line on the map from the Cape to Cairo. And that's because on geopolitical maps, British dominions were always denoted in red or pink. Rhodes had been instrumental in securing southern African states for the empire. He and others felt the best way to unify the possessions, facilitate governance, enable the military to move quickly to hotspots or conduct war, help settlement and foster trade, would be to build the Cape to Cairo Railway. And this great enterprise was not without its problems, as France had a conflicting strategy in the late 1890s to link its colonies from west to east across the continent, and the Portuguese had produced a pink map of their own, representing their claims to sovereignty in Africa. Ultimately, Belgium and Germany proved to be the main obstacles to the British objective, until the United Kingdom seized Tanganyika from the Germans as a League of Nations mandate. And I'm wondering if that was, no, that can't have been anything to do with the First World War, seizing Tanganyika from the Germans. But he did succeed in doing this, didn't he, Max, the Cape to Cairo Railway?
To be quite honest, I'm not absolutely sure. I think he may well have done so. And I would say that actually the seizing of Tanganyika probably was as a result of the First World War, it probably would have been either seized during the First World War or seized after the First World War, because that was when there was a lot of shuffling going on as a result of the settlement that was reached at the end of the First World War. I think that as far as the creating a red line from the south of the African continent right to the very north was an exercise in empire building, because one of the things that limits the size of empires, one of the things that limited the size of the Roman Empire, was the time that it took to travel from the capital of the empire to the extremities. Once it takes longer than a certain amount of time to travel from the capital to one of the extremities, it then creates a problem of communication, such that the extremities start to lose their link with the capital, and so therefore they become vulnerable to being attacked and perhaps being captured by a rival empire that might be next door. And so I think, as far as South Africa was concerned, Rhodes would have seen it as an instrument of securing the security of South Africa as a British colony, by creating the means to have a railway running from Cairo down to South Africa. And perhaps we ought to check and find out whether that was actually achieved. I think my recollection is that there was a red line running all the way through, but I couldn't say with absolute certainty.
I'm just thinking here, when we did Baden-Powell, there was mention of the Cape to Cairo Railway and the mention of working on it, and the frontiersmen from America, after they had finished with their Indian wars, coming over to South Africa, because of their skills that they had from the frontier in America, and then helping to build this Cape to Cairo Railway. And if Tanganyika was taken at the end of the First World War, which was 1918, it must have been sometime after Rhodes's death that it was actually finished. Just looking at that and you know, logically, if what we've just said is correct, it must have been finished after his death, because Baden-Powell was some years later, and Cecil Rhodes actually died when he was in his mid-40s, I think. Well, Rhodes wanted to expand the British Empire, because he believed the Anglo-Saxon race to be destined for greatness. In his last will and testament, he said of the English, "I contend that we are the first race in the world, and that the more of the world we inhabit, the better it is for the human race. I contend that every acre added to our territory means the birth of more of the English race who otherwise would not be brought into existence." These views struck a chord with Adolf Hitler, who claimed that Rhodes was the only Englishman who truly understood Anglo-Saxon ideals. Now, that may seem supremacist, but I would contend that actually what he's saying there is correct. If you don't have somebody ruling the world, if you don't, then somebody else is going to rule the world, and you want the best people to rule the world. And obviously, I think the best people are the British people. And at this time, there were a lot of other people that thought that were quite content to be ruled over by the British. Plus, I mean, what he's talking about here is the truth. At that time, we needed territory. We still need it today. That's why we went out and settled America. That's why we went out to South Africa, because we knew we would continue to expand. We knew that we had to take over land so that our sons and our daughters in Britain could then go overseas, and they could settle this land. They could have their families there. They could make use of the resources, and they would improve the lives of the people that were there as well. I mean, he isn't saying here, I think it would be great for the English to rule over everybody else and rule over all these less civilized races. What he is saying is, their lives would be much improved by having the English race running their administration for them. And I think that was proved in Rhodesia, because you had English stock that were running Rhodesia, and it was a first world country. It was producing all the food for Africa. And as soon as you had black rule, as soon as you had Robert Mugabe in charge, all of that was destroyed. All of that was destroyed. The blacks were in a far worse state than they ever were when it was in white hands. They were being tortured. They were being necklaced with these tires. They were starving. And even now, in Rhodesia or in Zimbabwe, they're actually asking for the white farmers to come back. So I think Cecil Rhodes is vindicated, particularly in that case of the country that was named after him, that having the English there running that administration was so much better for the blacks that were there than it has ever been since then with the blacks running the place. Would you agree with that, Max?
Yeah, I would say that was definitely the case. And I think it's also the case with South Africa. It's also the case with all of the other countries that were part of the British Empire back in the day. And while you've been speaking, I've just been Googling so that we can confirm. And yes, a red line was eventually created all the way from South Africa all the way through to Egypt, which started from South Africa and would have gone through what was later called Southern Rhodesia, into Northern Rhodesia, which then went through Tanganyika, which we lately obtained from the Germans, into Uganda, Kenya, Anglo-Egyptian Sudan, and then eventually into Egypt. So that line was created. And by having that line, if a continuous fast-track railway had been established running all the way through from Cairo to, say, Cape Town, then that would have eliminated the reliance that the world had on the Suez Canal at the time, because the Suez Canal, I don't think was constructed by the British, but we eventually bought it. But the point is that shipping from around the world that wanted to get through to Europe from the East Indies at the time would have had to have travelled through the Suez Canal or taken the long route round the Cape of Africa, whereas an alternative route would have been a railway route that would have gone from South Africa through to Cairo, and then would have just left a short journey through the Mediterranean and the North Atlantic through to Britain and Northern Europe. So, I think that the aim that Cecil Rhodes had was certainly born out of his desire to see a British empire spanning the world effectively.
And a better world for everyone, you know.
Yes.
You know, I think if you're going to have a globalist system, then that is a much better way of doing it than the way we have it now. Oh, everybody's equal. Everybody has the same value. Back then, it was, well, these people have value as humans, but we can't let them make the decisions, the important decisions, because they're not educated enough to. They don't understand civilization enough in order to run up-to-date modern countries. And they were proved right.
I think Cecil Rhodes was described as a racist because people thought that the fact he described some of the African peoples as being childlike, and we spoke about this the last time we discussed Cecil Rhodes. The fact of the matter is that Cecil Rhodes did make contracts and deals with African leaders who were found to have had an education and who were found to have been intelligent enough to have understood the concepts necessary in order to enter into that kind of a contract. And so, you know, whilst he in reality, he would have perhaps more accurately be described as somebody who discriminated against people on the basis of their ability, rather than discriminating against them on the basis of purely of their race, because if they were of a different race but they had the ability, then he was quite happy to deal with them and to make pacts and contracts, etc., with them. But if they obviously weren't, because they had never seen writing or written paper or something of that sort, then he would have made the judgment that it was impossible to deal with those people in the way that you would deal with a European person, because they just would have lacked the attributes to be able to understand what he was trying to get them to do.
That's a good point you make there, you know, about discriminating based on ability. I mean, it is a myth that nationalists discriminate based on the colour of the skin. It's not. It's based on ability. It's based on pattern recognition. And the fact that Rhodes talked about the African race as being children shows more of a paternalistic desire or a paternalistic way of thinking about them. I mean, he wasn't saying they're savages. He was saying they're like a childlike race, which means they need guidance. They need good examples set before them, which, of course, when you just hand it over to themselves and say, well, there you go, you run everything now, they don't have good examples amongst themselves to look to. Whereas before, they were taught to sort of, in fact, they naturally looked up to the Anglo-Saxon. They naturally looked up to the Englishman who would set a good example, who would have these high morals, who they would rather be judged by than judged by their own. Well, Rhodes wanted to make the British Empire a superpower in which all of the British-dominated countries in the empire, including Canada, Australia, New Zealand and the Cape Colony, would be represented in the British Parliament. Rhodes included American students as eligible for his Rhodes scholarships, as he wanted to breed an American elite of philosopher kings who would then encourage the United States to rejoin the British Empire. As Rhodes also respected and admired the Germans and their Kaiser, he allowed German students to be included in the scholarships too. He believed that eventually the United Kingdom, including Ireland, the United States and Germany together, would dominate the world and ensure perpetual peace. And that was quite a common idea, I think, at the time. Didn't H.G. Wells have a similar idea that it would be the Anglo-Saxon countries that would that we'd have like a new world order that would be running things in government? Am I getting that right there, Max? H.G. Wells?
Yeah, I think you are broadly right. I've read quite a lot of the writings of H.G. Wells, and he again was somebody who wasn't a racist in the sense that he wanted to discriminate against all people who were other than white. His writings indicate that he believed that Europeans could deal on equal terms with certain people from other races, and that where we could, that we should. And so I think that there is quite a large area of overlap between both Cecil Rhodes and H.G. Wells.
And you can see why Hitler was impressed with him as well. And Hitler always had a liking for the English. And it was probably through Cecil Rhodes that he actually had that liking and wanted to have an alliance with the English and never wanted to go to war against Britain, as he wrote about in Mein Kampf. And this idea of having all the British dominions, representatives of them in the British Parliament, and he's really sort of envisioning a world which really does fulfill the instructions in Genesis to go forth and take dominion. When it says in the Bible, go forth and take dominion, take over the world, basically. Because if we don't do it, who else is going to? You know, would you want black people to be running the world? Would you want Chinese to be running the world? Would you want Japanese to be running the world? I would suggest that really you would want Anglo-Saxons to be running the world. And of course, what we have today, we have this multicultural system with diversity quotas, and instead of having the very best people, the most qualified people, the most, you know, the most fit to rule in positions of leadership and authority, we end up with the least fit to rule that are only there either because of what race they are or what gender they are, or they're just there because the most people have voted for them. The majority have voted for them, which is basically the mob. Instead of the elite deciding who should be, who is best qualified, we end up with the least qualified people to make that kind of a decision, making that decision. And that's democracy. I think democracy would work much better if we just had people that were educated deciding these things and having a vote. Well, let's have a look at his views on race. Rhodes' views on race are today the subject of debate. Critics have labelled him as an architect of apartheid and a white supremacist, particularly since 2015. Rhodes advocated for the governance of Indigenous Africans living in the Cape Colony as a subject race because he saw them as being in a state of barbarism and communal tenure. He said, "I do not go so far as the member for Victoria West, who would not give the black man a vote. If the whites maintain their position as the supreme race, the day may come when we shall be thankful that we have the natives with us in their proper position." So what is that bears out what you were saying there, Max, about if they did have blacks that were up to a certain standard, then he would treat them as equals, because he's saying there, certain among the blacks, I would give them the vote. And we heard, I think, yeah, back in the first episode about how it was if they owned a certain amount of property, which showed that they had enough business sense, enough drive to actually earn enough money in order to buy this property, then they would be given the vote. Then they would be given a say in how things were run. And if he's saying there that we have them with us in a proper position, and what he's meaning there is we want the blacks to support us, then he's quite clearly not talking about mistreating them, is he? You know, if he was mistreating them, they wouldn't support him, would they? No. Scholar and Zimbabwean author Peter Godwin, whilst critical of Rhodes, writes that Rhodes and the white pioneers in southern Africa did behave despicably by today's standards, but no worse than the white settlers in North America, South America, and Australia, and in some senses better, considering that the genocide of natives in Africa was less complete, for all the former African colonies are now ruled by indigenous peoples, unlike the Americas and the Antipodes, most of whose aboriginal natives were all but exterminated. Well, I would argue against that. I would say I don't think the Australian natives, I don't think they were exterminated. In America, there was a war. There was the Indian Wars. Obviously, much of them were wiped out. And in South Africa, they came up with a system of keeping these people alive and just living separately. And why is apartheid seen as such a bad thing? You know, black people living among black people and white people living among white. What a horror! How horrible that must have been to live among your own people. It's ridiculous, isn't it?
The other thing to think about in the case of North Africa and South America is that you had individual tribes of American Indians prior to Europeans going there, and those individual tribes used to fight amongst themselves and used to genocide each other when they, you know, when one side won, and they would kill all of the remaining survivors of the other side, perhaps the women that they would then use as breeding stock or something of that sort. The only difference between what Europeans did and what the North American tribes were doing to themselves anyway is that we were more technically advanced, and we were so much better at fighting wars than they were. And so therefore, our people conquered the continent where no individual North American tribe, for example, was able to conquer the entirety of North America. They just had their own little territory, and that was that. And so I think what happened in the creation of North America and the colonization of Canada and North America and South America and the Antipodes it shouldn't be regarded as there being like a cold-hearted genocide of all those people. It should just be seen as a series of wars that are used to settle to spread civilization to those countries, and that the only reason the native people lost out to the colonizers was as a result of the fact they were nowhere near as good at fighting wars.
And they did start these wars as well. I mean, people forget that. I mean, land was bought from them. There were deals made with these natives. The white man wasn't seeking to rip people off or subjugate people or enslave people. He made deals with them, and they went back on those deals, and they would start cattle rustling. And whether it was because they didn't understand, because we're told, the Indians didn't understand about how people could own the land, but they seemed to understand enough when they were making the deals and they were being paid for the land. And, you know, there was a treaty that they would stay over there and we would stay over here, and we would grow our crops and we would farm our animals, and then the Indians would steal them. And then some of the other Indians would start stealing the women and stealing the children. So it's not like these wars that we had over there in America were just, you know, let's just invade America and take over. It wasn't like that at all. There was bad behavior on the Indian side that needed it needed a response from the white settlers. And as you say, you know, it was a different situation that they had in South Africa. There really weren't that many blacks there. There were the Hottentots and the Bushmen. As you said in that first episode, Max, the Sand people, they were there. And once the white people had got there and they built this civilization, that's when the blacks arrived. And they were treated very well. They said, well, you can have this land over here. You can come and work in our mines. We will pay you. We will educate you. We'll build you schools. We will build you hospitals. And they actually did very well out of it. And at the end of it, they were given a functioning first world country, but just because of the way that they are, because they are a different race to us, they're not capable of, you know, they're not capable of maintaining it. And if we just kept the system that Cecil Rhodes had, they would be better off, and we would be better off. I've got one final thing here that's also being said about him now, because people are accusing him of being racist, and there are actual accusations that he was homosexual now as well. And that's because Rhodes never married, pleading, "I have too much work on my hands," and saying that he would not be a dutiful husband. Modern historians have, of course, tried to claim he must have been homosexual because of this, and also because he had a male private secretary who he made the beneficiary of his will. Now, I wonder if the male secretary that was given the beneficiary, made the beneficiary of his will, if that wasn't to have the secretary hand out that money to who he wanted it to go to. I really don't think he would have been a homosexual. I don't have difficulties in thinking that our people 100 years ago were quite happy to be celibate. A lot of them were. Baden-Powell was celibate right up until about the age of 56. When we went out to conquer the New World, all the men that went over there were celibate. There's a book called "Are We a Declining Race? An Old Sailor's Tale," and I think it was written in about 1890, and that talks about the fact that everybody was celibate, and it was the fact that they were celibate that's what gave them this drive. And he says that on the continent, you had debauchery because they'd seen the way that the monkeys behaved in Spain and in Gibraltar. And because you didn't have monkeys in Britain, we didn't understand these things. And, you know, we would be celibate unless we got married. And he sees that as one of the reasons why we were such a hardy race and that we ended up with the British Empire in the first place. So I think Rhodes,
I think as far as Cecil Rhodes is concerned, whether he was homosexual or not is beside the point. The fact of the matter is that even if he was, he wasn't the sort of homosexual that wanted to parade his homosexuality in public. He didn't organise lascivious gay pride parades through the towns and cities that he created in South Africa. And if it turns out that he was homosexual, but he practices homosexuality in private, then so what?
Well, the thing is, I mean, they're trying to hold him up as some kind of gay hero today. Well, I guess they probably aren't actually, because they hate Cecil Rhodes, don't they? They have this Rhodes.
Well, that's right. It's a bit strange that they want to hold him up as a gay hero, but on the other hand, they want to demonise him as a racist.
Yeah, they must be a little bit.
They must be
a little bit
stuck between a rock and a hard place, mustn't they?
Well, I don't have any difficulty thinking that he was celibate. But as you say, Max, if he was homosexual, he certainly wasn't a flamboyant one. Because this is all that they can find, really, to suggest that he may have been, was just the fact that he didn't get married and he left his money to a private secretary. But you wouldn't have a female secretary, would you? If you were a frontiersman and you were going out there among these primitive tribes settling lands and building mines, the last thing you would want would be to be carrying a wife along with you that could be...
Having a wife would actually create a weakness. It would make him then vulnerable to her being attacked and him then having to decide what he was going to do if she was ever taken prisoner or anything of that sort. And it just creates complications that wouldn't exist if he had a male secretary.
And that's what he explains, isn't it? When he says, well, I would not be able to be a dutiful husband, that's what he means. He wouldn't have been able to guarantee her safety. Or either he wouldn't have been able to guarantee her safety, or he would have only been able to see her once a year. So, yeah. I mean, it makes perfect sense to me, his reason for not actually being married. Well, I guess we could probably leave it there, Max, rather than going into the Second Boer War, and we'll cover his death and his will and the Rhodes Scholarship next week, I think. So, thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Don't forget, we do require your donations to keep the website going, and now is the perfect time to buy Bitcoin because it's about half the price it was a couple of months back. We do have a Bitcoin wallet at the bottom of every page. It's very, very easy for you to buy Bitcoin on localbitcoins.co.uk, and any donations we receive are gratefully, very, very gratefully received. We will be back next week with more Air in Britannia for you, and of course we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.